must have been looking forward to his trip from England to the United States. He had his reservation in hand, even a very nice cabin on a steamship bound for New York City. But then in the last minute, his wife's medical problems got complicated and surgery was called for. He concluded that the only responsible thing to do was to cancel his trip. He was an Anglican pastor in London, and so with less than 24 hours to sailing time, Reverend J. Stuart Holden canceled his reservation for cabin D11 on the Titanic, that great showpiece of a ship that went down after hitting an iceberg in the North Atlantic Ocean on April 14th, 1912. Over 1,517 people, thanks, of the 2,200 plus people who were on board lost their lives. For J. Stuart Holden, his wife's illness, coming when it did, turned out to be, for them at least, a happy coincidence. Now, some Christians don't like to use the term coincidence because they think it detracts from God's sovereignty, but it doesn't, at least not if it's used properly. Naomi of Bethlehem, wife of the late Elimelech of Bethlehem, and mother of the late Mahlon of Bethlehem, and of the late Chilion of Bethlehem, this struggling believer Naomi, who had lost so much. Sometime in the two centuries before 1000 BC, experienced a happy coincidence on a day that turned her life around. And when she did, it renewed her confidence that God is committed to showing loving kindness to all of his children and not just to a few select ones. Now, some of you imagined that I could not do just one sermon on each scene in Ruth the first time around, and so not wanting to disappoint you, we're going back to Ruth chapter 2, the second scene in the story again today. We'll come to Ruth chapter 3 and scene 3 next week, but I struggled last Sunday to do justice to scene 2, and the sermon was too long as it was, so we're going back there today, Ruth chapter 2, page 413 in your pew Bible. There is a prologue, remember, it's in verses 1 through 5. We might title that Naomi's Excruciating Losses. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. And then we come to scene 1, which begins at verse 6 and goes all the way through chapter 1. And we might call that the homecoming. Last week and today also, now we are looking at scene 2, Ruth chapter 2. Which I would call the coincidence. Remember, if you were here last week, verse 1, now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. The storyteller wants us to know that fact, even though Ruth doesn't know it. And then we read this, the scene begins, and Ruth the Moabitess, and of the 20 times, I believe, that Ruth's name appears in the book of Ruth, 6 times she is referred to as Ruth the Moabitess, or Ruth from Moab. It's hugely significant given the ethnic and religious tension between the Israelites and the Moabites. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, this is her mother-in-law, let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor. Now, when we come to Ruth in the second circle around it, we're going to look at these gleaning laws, but this was part of social justice under the old covenant that farmers were not allowed to get every last little bit of crop out of their fields. That was for the poor to come after them and pick up. Naomi said to her, go ahead, my daughter. So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Now, what happens in the rest of the chapter here, up until the end of the workday when Ruth comes home from the field and tells Naomi what happened, it's really a remarkable story. In verses 4 through the first part of verse 19, it's a remarkable exposition of the incredible character of this man Boaz. First, just it gives you an idea of his general character. He comes into the field and he meets his employees with a blessing. The Lord be with you. But then toward Ruth, I counted up 11 different concrete acts of kindness toward Ruth. First, he inquires as to who she is. He takes notice of her. Secondly, he immediately invites her to glean his field. That is, he gives her official permission. And thirdly, he tells her to stay close to his own servant girls. Fourthly, he assures her that he has already given word to his men not to bother her in any way. Fifthly, he gives her permission to drink from his own jars. The poor might be allowed to glean in the fields, but the farmer was not obligated to provide food and refreshment for their break. Sixth, he compliments her on her devotion to her mother-in-law, and he pronounces a blessing on her. Seventh, he invites Ruth to have lunch with the workers instead of being off in the field by the side. Eighth, he gives her enough lunch so that she will have food left over. He has provided the meal for her already. He's given her too much. She winds up taking it home to Naomi. Ninth, he gives his workers instructions not to be too strict in the way that they police the gleaning. She's a foreigner. She maybe doesn't know the requirements. So even if she winds up gleaning in a part of the field where she should not be, leave her alone. 10, he tells them actually to take some of the barley grain that's already been harvested and scatter it around for Ruth so that she can pick it up. And then 11, he invites her to continue gleaning in his field for the whole harvest season. That's a remarkable story. I want us to look just very briefly, and we will come back to this again, but I want us to look briefly at the historical background here, because if we go back to verse 3 of chapter 2, I just read that to you. The second half of the verse goes like this. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz. One commentator says this is the way it should be translated. Her chance to be that she came to that part of the field belonging to Boaz. But then if we come down to verse 19, it's really quite amazing. She comes home. Her mother-in-law, Naomi, says, well, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. She sees almost a full bushel of barley that Ruth has brought back, and she's impressed. Somebody must have been kind to her. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. And my guess is she just told her detail by detail all that Boaz had done for her. And Naomi is amazed. And then she says, apparently at the end, and oh, by the way, the name of the man I worked with today is Boaz. And we come right back to verse 1. This was a relative. Naomi says in verse 20, the Lord bless him. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, he has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. And then she added, that man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers. And we said last week, if you have an ESV translation, they give us a more literal rendering here of verse 20. The ESV has, "May he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." It's not 100% clear who the whose refers to, whose kindness. And many commentators on this story argue this storyteller is a master literary person, and many think that he intentionally has left it ambiguous here whether Naomi is talking about Boaz or God, and many think, and this is probably right, she means both. But at the very least, she is concluding that God has been gracious and kind to her. Now, all of a sudden, when Naomi hears that this man who has been so kind to her daughter-in-law is actually a relative, and a fairly close relative, because she calls him a kinsman redeemer, what went into her mind? And I believe as soon as she heard his name, her wheels started turning, and she realized some of this social legislation under the old covenant that governed Israel. And it was that, as she begins to put two and two together, that was the turning point for her in coming to see that indeed God had not forgotten about her. Though in chapter 1, three different times, she defines herself, she refers to herself as the one against whom the Lord has acted. One writer says, and he puts it this way, there was a strong sense of family solidarity among the ancient people of God. It was true in the wider ancient world just in general. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 25. In Deuteronomy chapter 25, we come to the law of the so-called levirate marriage from the Hebrew word levir, which means brother-in-law. In Deuteronomy 25, beginning at verse 5, we read this. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. However, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the elders at the town gate and say, "My husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me." Then the elders of his town shall summon him and talk to him. If he persists in saying, "I do not want to marry her," his brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face, and say, "This is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line." That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled. A tremendous insult to the man who refuses to do justice to the importance that God himself attached to a man's name being perpetuated in Israel. Now, once you understand that this law was in effect, you could understand why you would always, if you were a woman, be very eager to know who your brother-in-law was going to be when there was a wedding. This was the responsibility. Now, if we turn to Leviticus chapter 25, Leviticus 25, beginning at verse 23, the passage in Deuteronomy is a passage about essentially redeeming a man's wife and his name. If you were a man in Israel and your brother died, you had a duty before the Lord to go into his wife, not to marry her, but to go into his wife that she might conceive and have a son, and that son would not be your son in the technical sense. It would be the son of your dead brother, and his inheritance, the land, would go to him. But it was also possible not simply to redeem people, but to redeem land. So we read in verse 23 of Leviticus 25, "The land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine, and you are but aliens and my tenants. Throughout the country that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells some of his property, his nearest relative is to come and redeem what his countryman has sold. If, however, a man has no one to redeem it for him, but he himself prospers and acquires sufficient means to redeem it, he is to determine the value for the years since he sold it and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it. He can then go back to his own property. But if he does not acquire the means to repay him, what he sold will remain in the possession of the buyer until the year of Jubilee." That is, every 49 years there was the year of Jubilee, and in that year it will be returned in the Jubilee, and he can then go back to his property. He would get his property back without making any payment at all. Now, as I said, we will come back to these laws, but this is the context here. And surely the implication is that when Naomi hears that it was Boaz who has been so kind to her daughter-in-law, her wheels begin to turn. And when she says, "That man is our relative, he is to us a kinsman redeemer," this is what she has in view. Now, this parallels other ancient peoples. It wasn't unique to the Israelites, the Assyrians, the Hittites. The Ugaritic cultures also practiced this kind of thing. Family solidarity was so much at the center of the collective social life of the people. Naomi hears that it was Boaz, and I believe that the implication of the storyteller is that this is where the penny drops for Naomi, with this hugely happy coincidence. Literally, the coinciding of two things. Ruth, on the one hand, representing the needs of Naomi and Naomi's deceased family, and then on the other side, Boaz, the potential meter of their need. You see, a coincidence is a description of the relationship between at least two events. It is not a description of any cause that might lie behind those events. It simply describes things happening together in concert. In some way, little did Naomi dream of this possibility, a buyback of her husband's land and a husband in Judah, no less, for her widowed daughter-in-law who was a Moabitess, and the prospect actually of an heir to continue Ruth's husband, Mahlon, his line. What words probably came back to Naomi as Ruth is pouring out detail after detail of Boaz's over-the-top kindness? Well, probably the ones she had spoken to Orpah and Ruth when she had tried to dissuade them from following her home to Bethlehem. Because, why? Because she thought that her life had become a dead-end street. If you go back to chapter 1, look at verse 13. She says, "Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up?" You see, she has in view also here the law about the brother taking his dead brother's wife. "But I'm old. I don't even have a husband. If I had a husband and we had a roll in the hay tonight and sons were born, are you going to wait until they grow up and have them marry you? Would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. The implication is, look, there's still hope for you. When she says, it is more bitter for me than for you. You don't want to hang around me. God has made me a magnet for disaster. If you get away from me, you'll get your life back. Don't come home with me. It's not even possible under the best conditions in Israel. But you see, here is God's wonderful surprise for Naomi. Naomi, in talking to her daughters-in-law, she thinks like you think and like I think. She comes up against a need. And the first place she goes to meet that need is the first savings and loan of her own meager resources. Not the infinite resources of the first bank of the universe, which belong to God. She goes first to her own resources, and that's sort of where she stops. It's impossible. It's a dead-end street. Stay in Moab. In her wildest dreams, Naomi never imagined that a prominent Bethlehemite Jewish man would take an active interest in a Moabite widow. But God is the God of the bizarrely wonderful. And it seems to come to Naomi as a revelation. A revelation, however, that comes through, via, by means of this happy coincidence that Ruth just happens to stop, look this way, look that way, evaluate the situation, and then make a choice, then pick up her first foot and turn toward this field and not that one, or that one, or that one. Ruth's decision is a very, very human decision, but in, with, and under, through, and behind it is the decision of God to do good to his daughter Naomi and to her men, because he really does love them. And notice that the storyteller doesn't have to beat us over the head with an editorial comment and say, see, look, it was God at work. Naomi sees it. She sees divine revelation in the coincidence. And so we see it too. In verse 20, when she says, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. In other words, me and Ruth, we're the living, and my husband and my sons are the dead. And the kindness of God has not been left off. It has not just been chopped off. It has not been stopped. Here, I believe, in that evening, is Naomi's revival, her renewal in the faith, her restoration to a much fuller confidence in the covenant-keeping loyalty of God, his loyalty to her and to her family. And it came, this revelation of God's favor toward her, it came completely hidden in a happy coincidence of two people meeting in a farm field. No prophet reveals it, no angel announces it. Just a woman happening to show up on the right spring day, at the right field, and the man just happening to check on his workers. You've got to keep an eye on your employees, right? Those of you who are managers. He shows up at the right time on this particular day. It is all the most amazing coincidence as these two things coincide. One writer put it this way, God's gracious provision for us, God's gracious provision for us often comes through the gracious generosity of others. But it is God's provision. And that's the thing that Naomi gets. It's what strikes her as a thunderbolt, I think, as she's standing there looking at this bushel of barley that Ruth has brought home, listening to Ruth describe detail after detail of Boaz going out of his way to help her as much as she can. And Naomi gets it. God hasn't forgotten about me after all. Wow, he really cares. It is amazing to me. It is wonderful. And so she not only pronounces a blessing on Boaz, but exclaims a great statement of praise to the Lord, who has not forgotten her. He was not just interested to take from her, but also to give. Naomi understood the spiritual truth laid out by one commentator on the story of Ruth, who wrote, "Here is a central theme in the Bible. All of life is traced directly to the hand of God." All of life is traced directly to the hand of God. Now, I would add, or indirectly, because I think that's the storyteller's point here. Remember that in the face of loss, Naomi had cried out to Orpah and Ruth, and it's recorded in verse 13 of chapter 1, "The Lord's hand has gone out against me." But here, in the prospect, in the face of at least the prospect, not of loss, but of gain, now Naomi cries out to Ruth, "May Boaz be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Do you get in your life the spiritual principle that Naomi here seems so clearly to grab hold of? That temporal provisions and the sometimes happy coincidences that bring them are supposed to be taken as evidence that God cares, that he is loyal to us, that he will provide what we need because he has promised us that he will do it. Every happy coincidence in your life and in mine is a testimony to God's covenant faithfulness. It's also a testimony to something else. What is that? God's power, his providence, his hand secretly working to orchestrate every creature on earth and all of their actions according to the principle that the Apostle Paul sets out in Philippians 3:21, where he is describing Jesus Christ as God. As the God who has what? Quote, "the power to bring everything under his control." That is the power of the living God, to bring everything under his control. A barley crop? The decision of a woman? The open-heartedness of a man? And so the real question is, can we see this morning how God has orchestrated things to bring good gifts into our life so often through happy coincidences? Some of you know the story of Hans and Susan Beyer and how they met. They just happened to be in Paris on the same day. They just happened, by chance they chanced, to go into the same cathedral in Chartres. They just happened to be on the same cathedral tour, led by an Irish mystic who invites some of them to hide out in the cathedral overnight because he knows the cathedral like the back of his hand. And Hans and Susan, naughty children that they were, hide out in the cathedral overnight, and they get this incredible tour through all of the underground passageways under the cathedral. That's where they meet. They chance, by chance, they chanced to be there. They were both looking for spiritual truth. They found one another. First, Susan found the Lord, and Susan was instrumental in Hans finding the Lord. Many people have said that the book of Ruth is about the providence of God. And it is. Question 18 in the Westminster Larger Catechism asks, what are God's works of providence? And the answer is this: God's works of providence are His most holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing all His creatures, ordering them, not commanding, not ordering in that sense, ordering them, that is, orchestrating their lives and all their actions to His own glory. And yet I agree with the commentator of Ruth who said this: something more than providence is involved in the story of Ruth. The entire story could have been told much more directly and plainly if the author's sole point were that God watches benevolently over the lives of His creatures. God's providence could have been traced openly, step by step, through the story without resorting continually to implications. The writer could have explained God's purposes along the way in his own reflection on the events of the plot instead of speaking only through his characters. Yes, the writer could have done all this, and his book would have lost its most characteristic feature and much of its appeal. There can be no doubt that the author of the book of Ruth deliberately wrote as he did. But the question that remains is his purpose in adopting this style of deliberate subtlety. This story is throughout a story about God. And as always, style and purpose are wedded. The reason for the book's deliberate subtlety lies in its aim to stress one particular aspect of God's providence, namely, its hiddenness. The author hides God's action during the entire body of the story simply because he feels it is by nature hidden. That's how God works. The book of Ruth, then, is a story about the hidden God. When we approach the story with the awareness that it deals with the hiddenness of God's acting in human affairs, we can understand even better how the writer fulfills his purpose by leaving things unsaid. With a thoroughness rarely encountered elsewhere, the writer portrays God's guiding hand as totally hidden in normal human causality. The book of Ruth implies that God uses the smallest, quote, accidental details. Yet there is clearly not the faintest hint that this total control exercised by the Lord in any way limits the freedom of activity of the people involved. They do as they wish. It's Ruth's choice, and their motives reflect the same full range of shades of gray that has always characterized reality. It is just this which gives the narrative its intensely realistic flavor. But while the writer in no way limits the freedom of the people whose lives he describes, he obviously nevertheless rejoices in tracing out the delicate manner in which God works all of their actions into His plan. The narrator's total hiding of God's hand is his forceful affirmation of his Lord's complete sovereignty. I believe that's true. It is a book about the providence of God, but it is about the providence of God at work in a hidden way in, with, and under the human choices and decisions and events of history as we know them. Whenever I walk past the crepe myrtle bush on the Fairlawn side of the Milligan house over here, I think of the Wilkies' terrible loss of little Kathleen 6 years ago, just a month shy of delivery. That little bush is planted in her honor. I think of that loss every time I walk by. But then I see that little towhead, Aaron, and now he can speak. And I see his older brother, Connor. And I remember that God is not only the God who takes, but he is the God who gives. This morning in the Sunday school class, we watched the life of Johann Sebastian Bach. I learned many new things about Bach's life, and one was just how much pain and loss Bach experienced. He was 9 years old when his mother died. She died in May. By November, he had a new mother. The following year, when he was 10, his father died. At 15, he has to bring in money for himself. He lives with his older brother. His first wife died when he was 35 and left him with 4 children. In all, apparently 8 of his children would die before they were 5 years old. Bach knew incredible loss and sorrow. But this is what he said on one occasion: God's gift to his sorrowing creatures is to give them joy worthy of their destiny. That's what he gave to Naomi. And Naomi got it. And she recovered the idea that had gone into the background. She had hung on to her faith. But what was right at the forefront of her thinking was, God is against me. God has taken from me. In a deep and profound sense, she was right to recognize the hand of God in that. But her confidence that God loved her had cooled. She finally discovers it again in this most remarkable gift that comes in a happy coincidence of Ruth, her daughter-in-law, meeting Boaz. Where are you this morning? Do you know the happy coincidences in your own life that should be counted as evidence that God cares, that God loves you? Do you need to be restored in his covenant-keeping faithfulness? Learn from Naomi. Blessed is he, and the God whose kindness has not been cut off from the living or the dead. He is a God of grace, and he loves you. Amen.